sorry to everybody for starting late. There are still going to be people coming, but the catechism of the First Communion is going on, so some people are coming down from that. I think some people just got stuck in traffic. So.
Yeah. Or some people decided.
What? This is perfect.
Maybe it's not their thing. That's okay. Shall we?
All right. So we'll open up. We'll open up in prayer. All right, so some of you are now new, and I think we're going to get a few other new people, at least if they were still coming. Last I heard, they were. And I know we have some people upstairs doing catechism, so I'm going to try to hold off doing too much that's really, really new, give them a little bit of a chance. So I thought it might be useful to go over the stuff that we had done last time, just really, really quickly. So last time we did epistemology, right? Reformed epistemology in particular. So I tried to introduce you guys to Plantinga's idea of what it means for a belief to be properly basic, and then introduce you to the notion that belief in God might be one of those beliefs. So you might have arguments for God's existence, and that might increase your confidence that God exists, and that's entirely appropriate. But you shouldn't think of arguments as entirely grounding your faith that God exists or your belief that God exists. You can have a perfectly rationally warranted belief that God exists on the basis of thinking that it's a properly basic belief, that it was formed by your cognitive faculties in a way that's normal, that your cognitive faculties weren't malfunctioning. They formed the belief in response to the world, just like most of your beliefs, any of your beliefs that are properly basic in the same way. That also doesn't mean that your belief is indefeasible or that nothing could ever overturn it. It just means that in the absence of a good reason to think you're wrong about something that's properly basic, you're well within your rights to think that it is true, right? And to continue to believe it, unless somebody gives you something that qualifies as a genuine defeater, a genuine reason to reconsider what was a properly basic belief. Now, I had made some comments last time, but as I listened back to the recording, this is part of the reason why I'm doing the recordings, is that I want to catch all of my mistakes. This wasn't necessarily a mistake, but I made certain points in a really scattered way that I'd rather just bring together, because one thing you might ask is, well, if we're focusing on arguments for God's existence, and we've started off by saying they're not important, or they're not so important that you have to stake your faith on them, maybe it's good to take inventory of what the use is even of having these arguments for God's existence. Why even look at them if you don't need them to rationally ground your faith? And I think that there are at least a few really important positive benefits to arguing or knowing the arguments for God's existence. So one of them is going to be that it offers you additional grounding or additional support, right? You might start off with a belief that's properly basic, and then you end up questioning that belief, and the result of that is that you have even more evidence to think that it's true. So what would defeat it for you would require even more evidence, right? If you have a properly basic belief that the table is white, but you've never really thought much about it, and somebody wants to convince you that actually, no, it's an optical illusion, it's not really white, whatever, well, the amount of evidence that they would need to give you to act as a defeater for that belief is probably lower than the amount of evidence that you would need to defeat your belief if you had investigated it and you found that, no, the table really is white. I know this, I've analyzed it, I've gone in, I know the reasons for thinking it's white. So it's first a properly basic belief, and then in addition to that, I have all these other reasons that increase my confidence that this is true. And similarly, your belief in God, even if it doesn't rely on arguments, you don't need philosophical arguments to have a perfectly justified or rational or warranted belief in God, still it increases your confidence, right? And that's a good thing even for you. So there's a certain notion of cultivating the intellect, let's say. So having, let's say, something like good intellectual hygiene is itself a good for human beings, for thinking people who are interested in the truth. It's good that we have a kind of reflective view of our own beliefs and that we can share that with other people in a thoughtful way. So the more thoughtful we are about those beliefs, the easier it is to share in a thoughtful way with others what those beliefs are and then defend them. Another benefit is, even though a lot of these arguments don't persuade anybody overnight, nobody goes from being, you know, an atheist to being a theist upon hearing one argument, or it's very, very rare that that happens to somebody, but still, the usefulness of these arguments might be that, first of all, it's like planting a seed. Right? If somebody is wondering if there are reasons for thinking that God exists, and then you give them a reason for thinking it, they might have to think about it for a while, but, you know, after having digested it, they might think, you know, that is pretty fair. It increases their, you know, the plausibility of theism for them. And I think, by extension, it also creates a kind of culture where theism and even Christianity can remain intellectually live options. So there are a lot of people for whom Christianity is just an intellectually dead option. Right? It might seem true to those of us who are Christians, but to many people who have no impressive vision of Christianity, who can't even imagine it being true, it's gobbledygook. To them, saying that Christianity is true just doesn't even compute. Right? So for them, it's not even an intellectually live option. And some of the reason for that might be they've never heard a good reason for even accepting the basic premise that God exists or something like that. Well, if you give them those reasons, then you're doing is you're giving them, you're taking away a kind of intellectual obstacle to belief, and you're turning theism and Christianity into an intellectually live option for them. If they can see that the argument works and they see the sense of it, they don't even have to think the argument is sound as of yet. They just have to be able to see the way that you're thinking, understand it, and say, okay, I can understand why somebody would think that. I can go along with that to some extent. So if you get somebody thinking that way, if you get the culture thinking that way, then you increase the probability that for any given person in the culture, that person is going to be intellectually open to hearing the gospel. They're going to be intellectually open to hearing Christianity. Whereas if you don't put out, suppose we had absolutely no arguments for God's existence anywhere, nobody ever shared them. I might be a pessimist, but I think that's pretty close to true if you look around in the church today. Then you're going to get people who are atheists or are just agnostics and so on, not because they've thought carefully about Christianity as a live option and rejected it, but because nobody's even given them the tools to think properly about whether Christianity is true in the first place. It's not a live option in a meaningful way for them. So that's one of the advantages of looking at arguments for God's existence. So it increases your confidence in God's existence. It does cultivate a kind of life of the mind, which is entirely appropriate, I think. And it also helps to create a culture, or sustain a culture, to whatever extent we still have it to sustain, in which theism and maybe Christianity in particular can be looked upon by those who don't accept either or both of them as intellectually live options nevertheless. So that's the very, very basic idea of framing arguments for God's existence as unnecessary but beneficial. So that's the first thing we did last time. Second thing we did last time, which I didn't expect to get to, so this was a little bit scattered as well, was the first argument for God's existence that we were going to look at, which I hope most of you remember it as the Kalam cosmological argument. So this argument goes roughly, first premise, anything that begins to exist has a cause. Second, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore, the universe has a cause. And then we analyzed what kind of cause the universe would have to have in order to get to either all the way to theism or within punching distance of theism, let's say. So what kind of thing could cause the universe to begin to exist? Well, it's got to be something that's other than the universe. It can't have any of the properties that are inherent to the universe, like being material or being in time, right, temporal. Any of those kinds of properties are properties that would be within the universe. And so to argue that something that had those properties created the universe would be to argue in a circle, right? It would be to say essentially that the universe causes itself to exist, or something that really would be part of the universe caused the universe to exist. And so we said it has to be immaterial, it has to be timeless, it has to be spaceless, it has to be incredibly powerful, and you know, as we're putting out one property after another, we're getting closer and closer on at each step to God. Now, you had pointed out it doesn't get us all the way there necessarily, because you might still be missing properties like God's moral properties. It's going to be very hard to infer a moral property of a creator merely from the fact that there's a creator or something like that. You can get there with other arguments, and of course there's nothing stopping us from using more than one argument, right? So it's a little bit of a mistake to think of arguments for God's existence as standalone arguments. Like, if this one doesn't get you all the way there, then it's useless, and then you should move on to the other. And if it doesn't get you all the way there, then it's useless and move on. You should think instead of arguments as presenting a kind of cumulative case. So what you're looking for is the truth. You're looking for what reality is like, and these arguments are tools for helping you figure out at least part of what reality is like with respect to God. And so one argument might get you that he's an immaterial, spaceless, timeless, incredibly powerful entity that created everything. And somebody might say, well, that's not God. So, okay, that's pretty close. But then you can move on to another argument and say, he also has these moral properties. You give a moral argument for God's existence, and you can show these moral properties. And they say, well, that doesn't get you to necessary existence or something like that. Okay, you can go through the arguments one at a time and treat them cumulatively in the same way that you would present, let's say, the typical way this is said is you present evidence in the courtroom, let's say. So you might have really good DNA evidence, but it's not entirely conclusive for some reason. You might have good eyewitness evidence, but that's not entirely conclusive for some reason. You might have really good, okay, each of the pieces of evidence might be good enough to make you confident, but not good enough to give you beyond reasonable doubt certainty. But put all of the pieces of evidence together and say, okay, what makes best sense of all of the pieces of evidence? Well, then you're getting a lot closer to this is now beyond reasonable doubt. And you can do the same thing with arguments for God's existence. You combine one after another to say, look, what explains all of this? The best explanation is going to be God, or at least that's, you know, that would be my contention. That's a typical theistic contention. I did also say something about that first premise. I actually ordered them differently the last time. It doesn't really matter what order the premises are in. But I said that there are good scientific reasons for affirming that the universe had a beginning. Right? So we referred to standard Big Bang cosmology, that there are or have been at least attempts to construct alternative cosmologies, and those have either failed, by and large failed, or at least they have failed to win over anything like a consensus among physicists. So the consensus view, which is still very strongly supported by the weight of evidence, is the Big Bang. And so it does suggest that the universe had an actual beginning a finite amount of time ago. And that gives you good reason for affirming that premise. But you'll remember I said that that argument goes all the way back, way, way before we had a Big Bang theory. Right? In fact, we call it the Kalam cosmological argument. Or one, the chief defender of this argument today is William Lane Craig. He's a philosopher. And he named the argument the Kalam in honor of a Muslim thinker in particular named Al-Ghazali. And this is going back to, I think, okay, somebody's going to have to fact check me after. I think it's like 9th century, 8th, 9th century, something like that. So very, very early on. So you might ask, well, okay, how did they defend the argument? They didn't have any of our scientific knowledge, right? They had none of the evidence that we would point to when we look at modern science and say, cosmology gives us good reasons to think the universe had a beginning. So what kinds of arguments were they using? There were arguments there that are kind of interesting, and I felt like we glossed over them way too quickly, so I kind of want to give you guys a sense of that philosophical way to defend that premise, that the universe had a beginning. So put science aside. Suppose somebody says that they're not convinced by standard Big Bang cosmology or whatever. Can you still defend that premise in this argument? You can, and there are a few ways to do it, but the basic way to do it is to call into question what the contrary would mean. What would it mean for the universe to actually be infinitely old? It would mean that there had been an actually infinite number of events, or days, or what have you, that had transpired all the way back to no beginning. Right? The universe never had a beginning, it's just always been here. And that is one answer that atheists used to very typically give, is they would say, the universe is just infinitely old. If it doesn't have a beginning, you don't really need a creator. Now, I think that's actually misconceived, as we'll see in the next argument, but for the purposes of this argument, you can press the point a little bit, either scientifically or philosophically, by saying there's a problem with the way that you're using the idea of an infinite or an actual infinity. Have any of you guys heard of Hilbert's Big Hell? Yeah, okay, so you have. So a couple people have, that's good. So there's this thought experiment it was proposed by a mathematician, Hilbert, and it goes roughly as follows. And this is gonna be mind-boggling, but the point of this thought experiment is that it's supposed to boggle the mind, and it's supposed to help demonstrate that the idea of the infinite is a useful, it's a useful thing to use as a kind of fiction, but it's not something that can exist in reality. Right? There's a problem when you try to bring the idea of the infinite into the real world. You can create these paradoxes that it looks like you're not going to be able to get out of without just getting rid of the idea of the infinite. So here's the thought experiment. For those of you who have never heard this before, this will be fun. So imagine there's a hotel, and it's a hotel with infinitely many rooms, and all of the rooms are currently occupied. So you walk into this hotel and you want a room. You go up to the person at the counter and you say, I would really like a room. They say, I'm sorry, we're full. We don't have any space left. And you say, okay, but I really, really want a room. I need a room. I'm not leaving until I get a room. And so the person at the counter thinks, and they happen to be, you know, a pretty good math student, and they start thinking, okay, maybe I can solve this, actually. I think I can. I will ask everyone to move one room over from the room that they're in. So the person in room one, I'm gonna ask them to move to room number two. And the person in room two, I'm gonna ask them to move over to room three to four, and so on and so forth. Now, in this infinitely large hotel, that means that everyone moves over a room and nobody is left without a room. For any person in the hotel with any room number, you're gonna be able to find a room that they go to, and there's nobody left over. But all of a sudden, room number one is now empty. Nobody has left the hotel. You can now occupy that room. There are infinitely many people in the hotel. Infinitely many plus you equals infinitely many. So there's no problem. There's no issue whatsoever. Then you might think, to make the problem even worse, because that was a neat trick, right? You let one person in. What if you actually show up with an infinitely large bus of people, infinitely many people on the bus, and all of you need a room? And so again, you go to the counter, and the person at the counter says, I'm sorry, every single room is taken, you have no vacancies here. And you say, okay, we really need rooms, we're not leaving until you give us a room. Okay, all right, so what are we gonna do? And the person at the counter thinks again, I know what to do. I'll take the person in room one, and I'll move them over to room two. The person in room two, I'll move them over to room four. The person in room four to eight, and so on, the person in room three to six. So everyone is just moving to an even numbered room, right? You're doubling whatever room number you have and going to that room. Yet again, there's nobody left without a room, infinitely large hotel, but now the only rooms that are occupied are all the odd numbered rooms, or the even, sorry, numbered rooms. And all of the odd numbered rooms are left vacant. So now you have infinitely many free rooms, and you can just fit everyone on this infinitely large bus into the hotel, right? And that seems pretty absurd, But here's where the problem gets really, really bad. Infinitely many people check out the next morning. How many people are left in the hotel? This is actually a problem. You can't figure out how many people are left over. It could be that you still have infinitely many people, right? Because maybe it was everyone in a prime number room that happened to leave. You still have infinitely many people in the hotel. Maybe it's everybody in the odd number of rooms. Okay, you still have infinitely many people in the hotel. Maybe it's everyone other than people in rooms 1 through 7. You know, you have 7 people left in the hotel and that's it. You don't have anybody else. So you actually end up with mathematically contradictory answers to what seems like a straightforward arithmetical question. You have infinity, you subtract infinity from it, and you end up with different incompatible mathematical solutions. And so it's actually for this reason that mathematicians, when they're doing what's called transfinite arithmetic, you're not even allowed to do subtraction, right? These are called inverse operations. You're not allowed to use inverse operations in transfinite arithmetic. But as philosophers point out, that's a rule. That's a rule that's been introduced for the sake of keeping a certain mathematical system coherent and allowing us to use it in a way. But there's a real problem where if you imagine that infinitely many things can exist in the real world, if that were even possible, you could conceivably have an infinitely large hotel, right? So imagine a hotel that adds one room every single year as time ticks on, and it's always been doing this. Well, if the universe is infinitely old, you're going to have an infinitely large hotel, right? And you're going to keep adding rooms, but it's already infinitely large. So, if that's right, you could actually have something like a Hilbert's hotel in reality, and you could end up with these paradoxical problems. Another, you know, a philosopher William Lane Craig gives the following example. He says, suppose that I had like an infinite number of cookies, right? And I want to give some away. Suppose I give infinitely many of them away, and a mathematician walks up to you and says, "You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed inverse operations. You're not allowed to subtract infinity from an infinity." Well, it doesn't matter to me. I have the cookies. I can give away however many I want. I give away infinitely many. And now, tell me, mathematician, how many do I have left? Well, there is no singular correct answer to that question. There are only mathematically coherent answers that are contradictory to that question. So if you follow that argument, if you follow it, and if you feel like, yeah, Hilbert is right, there's probably something wrong with the idea of an actual infinity, then you can use that argument to say, if the universe, just hypothetically, if the universe were infinitely old in this imagined way that the atheist might want to say, then you end up with these paradoxes. You end up with problems, and the root of those problems is, at least plausibly, that you're bringing an idea that's really just meant to be like a useful heuristic in mathematics into the real world where it doesn't really belong. It's like arguing from the use of frictionless planes in some idealized physics that there could be such a thing in reality. Well, maybe there are problems with that, right? And similarly here, maybe there are problems with there being an actually infinite number of things. So I went through that very quickly, but that's only just because I thought it was neglected last time, because we really focused on the science and we didn't talk at all about the philosophical argument. But the basic philosophical argument is that you can't have an actual infinite in reality. And what the person who says the universe has always been here really wants is to say that there is an actually infinite number of events in the history of the universe. And that just opens this Pandora's box to real problems with your worldview, real problems in reality, if you accept that those things could be possible, like a Hilbert's hotel, or there are other examples philosophers use. But that's a very, very basic, that's a very basic way to run through the point. There are philosophers who will be very careful about distinguishing different kinds of infinities and make arguments that are more precise. They'll say, well, is not just any kind of infinity, it's an infinite causal series that's a problem or something like that. But I think for our purposes, we don't need to go through each of those individual arguments. It's enough, I think, to make the general point that philosophers are concerned with paradoxes that come from admitting actually infinitely many things into reality, and you would have to do that, in principle, if the universe were infinitely old. So this gives us a good reason to think, without appealing to science at all, it's a good reason to think the universe has a beginning sometime in the finite past. And this is the kind of argument that inspired defenders of this type of cosmological argument through the medieval period and then into the present day. So these kinds of arguments are still used today. Okay, I'll stop there. Are there any questions at all about that? Because I know I ran through that really quickly. Yeah.
Well, they say God is infinite.
Okay, yes, very good. Right. So it's important to recognize that what we're talking about here when we're using this example of an infinitely large hotel or a universe with an infinite past, we're talking about a quantitative infinite. There are ways of speaking, Duns Scotus would speak like this, where you can say of God that he is infinite in a kind of qualitative sense. But we don't mean that God is infinite in a quantitative sense. So to illustrate this, suppose you say God is infinitely good. Okay, that seems right. But when we say that, what we're not saying is there's a way to measure goodness in terms of units, right? And God has not like 5 units of goodness or 100 or, no, he has literally infinitely many units of goodness. That's not what we mean when we say that God is infinitely good. We mean that he is good without limit. And so it's worth making a distinction. I was going to try to avoid this because I wanted to be as little, not get us bogged down in too many technicalities, but this one might be worth it. So most of you have seen the symbol of the sideways 8, right, which is a limit concept that people learn in high school. That is not the kind of infinite that we're talking about here. The kind of infinite that we're talking about here is represented as an aleph null. Philosophers and mathematicians try to write it this way because we're talking about an actual, something we're treating as though this is an actual number. It's an actual value, aleph null, like a number. It's just the first transfinite number. That's how mathematicians want to refer to it. And so philosophers will say, okay, but there's a real distinction here between a potential infinite and an actual infinite. So if we're talking about quantitative infinities, they come in these two varieties. And if we're talking about God, we're talking about a qualitative infinity, not a quantitative one at all. But in terms of quantitative ones, you have the sideways 8, which is a kind of limit concept, goes on to infinity or is unending in some series. And the other value, aleph null, is this is a real number. This is a real cardinal number. It's a real value. Maybe you could have literally infinitely many things, right? So let's say I'm writing out the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then I keep going, I write dot, 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 and it just goes to infinity. That would be expressed as a limit. But now suppose I say, take the set of all natural numbers. How many members does that set have? Well, now the value you're thinking about is this kind of aleph null value. It's this actually infinite number of things. And what philosophers are doing in this argument, at least, is saying that's the suspicious thing. You can do that in mathematics. You can do whatever you want in mathematics, really, so long as your system is coherent. But as soon as you try to bring that thing into the real world, you end up with problems. You can have Hilbert's hotels in your mathematics. That's fine. You can't have a Hilbert hotel down the street. That's what you can't have. You can't have infinitely many cookies to give away. You can't have infinitely many anything. And so the second somebody tries to say there are literally, actually, infinitely many things, quantitatively, that's where at least the person who defends this way of defending this premise and this argument will say, you can't do that. You can't do that. But you are right, yeah, because that's a question that comes up often as well. We say that God is infinite. What's what do we mean when we say that? And I think ultimately to say God is infinite is a kind of shorthand way of saying God is without limit. But that doesn't mean that God is quantitatively, literally, infinitely many things or collection of things or that he has parts or anything like that. So it's not really a problem in that sense. Yeah.
So I know we're not supposed to dwell too much on technicalities or even, you know, this is kind of a very much a...
Well, that's for me. That's for me, not for you guys. You can ask anything you want.
So you said that philosophers, you know, they're interested not so much in the limit concept, but rather in, you know, the first transfinite cardinal number, Aleph Null.
Yeah.
But why stop at Aleph Null? Like, you know, okay, that's the smallest infinity, the countable infinity.
Yeah.
You know, the cardinality of some of the natural numbers. But wouldn't the next size infinity pose even more problems? Like, why are we just focused on the first one?
Right, right. Well, the idea is that if you can show that there are problems that arise with the first one, then suppose you take the, you know, the set of old reals that I believe is Aleph 1, right? Okay, that's a larger set of infinity. You can actually prove that it's a larger set using set theory. But if the first one is too much of a problem because you have infinitely many things, then having a larger quantity of infinity is also going to be a problem for the exact same reason, right? You could have a Hilbert hotel that has Aleph null rooms and it gives you a problem. If the one with Aleph null gives you a problem, the one with Aleph 3 or Aleph 14 or Aleph Aleph is going to give you the same kind of a problem, if not a worse problem, right? So yeah, we could go through every single series of transfinite infinite numbers, but if you can show that the smallest one is too big, you've shown that all of them are too big, right?
Okay, no, that makes sense. And you know, while you were speaking, I was trying to rack my brain thinking of if there could be something that is Aleph null in the world, but even at the smallest scales, we speak of the Planck length and we speak of limits to the discreteness of reality. So even the small or the big, we don't find infinity. We find very much finiteness.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
It's crazy and to think that, you know, a child writes the number 0, the number 1, and between 0 and 1, there are, you know, way more than Aleph null numbers.
Yes.
And already just in that construction, we hold it in our minds and we contemplate something that is impossible.
Right, right. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Could you have infinity in a closed system? Like, for say, let's say, the source of the Amazon River.
Okay, so if you meant by that something like there is a potentially infinite supply of water, so take the following case. Suppose I say something like heaven will go on forever, right? Well, depending on what you mean by that, you might just be saying, look, heaven is unending. It's going to tend forever towards infinitely many, say, days in heaven. But at no point will you be able to say, aha, now there have been infinitely many days in heaven, right? At any point on any day in heaven, you're going to be able to point to there have been 3 billion, there have been 14 trillion, there's always going to be some finite number of days that have transpired since, I'm imagining it's a sort of the eschatological heaven, right? So the heaven at the end of the world. There's always going to be more coming, and you're ever approaching and never reaching infinity as a kind of limit to that. So if you meant something like that for raindrops, then yeah, that would be perfectly legitimate, and it also wouldn't be a problem because the kind of infinite that we're worried about is, again, not qualitative but quantitative, and not just quantitative but the one that says it's actual, that there's an actually, literally actual number of raindrops. Now, if you meant that latter thing, you didn't just mean that there were potentially infinitely many raindrops as time goes on. If you meant that in the real world there are actually infinitely many raindrops, then yes, that will be a problem, right? Or it will be a problem for this argument.
Yeah, I'm thinking about like in a closed, like a water system, right? Water doesn't enter, or water doesn't leave.
Right. But then
it's always there.
Right, but if it never enters and never leaves,
yeah,
and you have a finite amount of it all around, then the amount of water is actually
right,
a planet.
Right.
And you might say, well, it's just going to continue going. You can always use it. It's recycled in the system or something like that. Okay, well, then you're talking about water at any point in that cycle will be potentially infinite, right?
Yeah.
Every
yes.
renewable.
Yes.
But that's not an actual infinity of the kind that poses the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when somebody says the universe is infinitely old, in the literal sense, what they're committing themselves to is, yeah, there really are, or at least can be, there's no reason or principle to say that there couldn't be, infinitely many things, like infinitely many rooms in Hilbert's Hotel, or you know, infinitely many cookies, or any number of other things that you know keep philosophers awake at night because they think that, that can't be right. There can't be those kinds of things in the real world. So, and not everybody accepts that, right? There are really good philosophers who think that actually you can have an actually infinite number of things, including many Christian philosophers who just don't think that this is a great argument for this premise. You could go that route, but at least if you think that's right, so you've now heard that kind of argument laid out, if you find that that's intuitive, that it seems right that there shouldn't be infinitely many things, well, then that's one way in which, forgetting the science altogether, you can give a perfectly good philosophical argument, strictly philosophical, for thinking the universe could not have been infinitely old. It has to have a finite past. Otherwise, you end up with these paradoxical possibilities, and it's not clear how you could deal with them. And in fact, for the person you're talking to, suppose you're talking to an agnostic or an atheist or anybody who says, yeah, I think there really could be infinitely many things, well, then you might just pose a Hilbert's Hotel as a kind of thought experiment and say, well, what do you do with that? Right? How do you deal with that? Maybe they have some clever way to deal with it. It could be. But I think I find it highly plausible to think that, that there are real problems with posing infinities like this. But that I also was careful to note that there are some people who defend this argument without giving this very general attack on the idea of an actual infinite. They'll be more precise and they'll say, okay, maybe I'll spot you that there could be some actual infinities, but not this kind of actual infinities. And they'll say something like a causal chain with infinitely many causes. Maybe that poses a real problem. There's a really good philosopher, one of my favorite living philosophers actually, Alexander Pruss at Baylor University, and he used to think that this argument was no good. He's got a PhD in mathematics and a PhD in philosophy. Definitely a math guy, and he thought, yeah, there could be infinitely many things. I'm open to that idea. And he, because of that, he thought this Kalam argument wasn't very good. You could maybe make an argument on scientific grounds, but this philosophical argument, he didn't think much of it. And over the years, he fought his way into a different way to defend this premise, where he says, okay, even if I was right, maybe I wasn't, but even if I was right that there could be infinitely many things, you can't, without having serious philosophical puzzles, have infinite causal chains. And so if that can't happen, the universe having an infinitely, being infinitely old, is going to have an infinitely long causal chain. The causal story leading up to today goes back yesterday, the day before, and so on, ad infinitum. And that might be a problem, because the story you tell there is going to wind you, it's going to give you a kind of paradox. So there are different ways of going about defending that premise in the argument that the universe had a beginning. You don't have to stick to this way. Some people who don't think this is plausible at all just use the scientific arguments. Other people who think the scientific arguments are terrible, but these are the really good arguments, they'll just use the philosophical arguments. So it doesn't matter what physicists are saying, we can just prove this with these kinds of paradoxes from infinity. I hope that's relatively clear. Okay, all right, so that was the Kalam. I'm gonna close that now and say we are now essentially done the Kalam. We've reviewed it, I gave the philosophical arguments that I didn't give last time because I thought they were lacking, so I thought we needed to do that. Now today, what we're gonna do is pretty quickly, hopefully, look at two new arguments for God's existence. One of them is going to be another kind of cosmological argument for God's existence. So the Kalam cosmological argument that we just did says that the universe had a beginning, and that acts as a kind of key premise in that argument. But you might give a cosmological argument that concedes to the critic that the universe maybe is infinitely old. Say the universe is infinitely old. Hey.
Let's take a second here. Did you guys finish upstairs now with the kids? Okay. Maybe we'll just ask if anyone wants a pee break or anything.
Yeah.
Just so that we can also allow Jane to maybe grab a coffee.
Yes. Well, there are a few, right, coming down?
Grab a donut.
Yeah. You're welcome to. Actually, maybe that is a kind of natural place to take a short break at least, because we've just reviewed, so almost everything we just did was reviewing, except putting a little bit more meat on the bones of the clum. So we'll stop there for maybe a few minutes, and then...
5 minutes or something, just allow some others to come back down, or have that little break, or replenish some coffee, or grab some of that wonderful baking again.
I can tell some of you actually really know a lot of this material, right? You've heard of William Lane Craig, I presume? Have you heard of William Lane Craig? Or are you familiar with any of his work?
Actually, no.
Really? I'm surprised. Okay, so you knew about transfinite arithmetic and so on, completely apart from...
I just knew about that because that's kind of mathematics.
Okay.
Not related to philosophy.
Right. Okay. Yeah, usually the people who know about it are either mathematicians, or the small little contingent of philosophers who care a lot about that argument from infinity or related arguments, and nobody else has any idea what you're talking about. You throw around Alec Mell at a party. Typically nobody really cares what that is.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think of infinity. I also think of the biblical reference for a day is a thousand years to God.
Right.
Years a day, it is a thousand years. So
yeah.
An infinite model. Time collapses, right? It can't qualify infinity. So does distance. So if God is the only singularity, like God is eternity, or God is eternity, or God is infinite, then everything else can be placed in units from that. Like if God is the one who is outside of it all, because he is, there's no beginning, there is no end, it's infinite. If God can then set the conditions, then from those conditions you have time and distance, and so there can be infinity in the creation. Does that make sense? God's outside of the creation.
That there can't be infinity?
Yeah.
Okay. I agree with you. I thought I followed you, but I didn't get from what you said before to the very last step. I missed a step in how you were thinking, I think.
God's outside space and time.
Right,
so,
okay.
So God is infinity.
Right,
then
okay.
God has created the conditions for space and time. So
yes, okay.
It's
like that
kind of closed system. God is creating a closed system. God is outside of that.
Right. But then you might want to say, okay, so right. So could God create Aleph Null, a universe with Aleph Null number of things? Right. Now if you think it's logically impossible for there to be Aleph Null things in reality, then even God isn't going to be able to do that, because God can do anything that's logically possible. But the property of being omnipotent is usually thought of as a modal property, which is just to say it's a property that's expressed in terms of logical possibility. God can do any of a number of logically possible things. But as soon as you put words together in such a way that you're expressing a logical impossibility, well, the doctrine of God being all-powerful doesn't entail you can do that. So could God create a square circle? Or could God create a rock so heavy that he couldn't lift it, or something like that? Well, that sounds at first blush like a meaningful combination of words, but on closer analysis, it doesn't actually mean anything. And so it's not a real possibility. And so, no, God can't do it, but that's not a problem for God's being all-powerful. Similarly, if you think that it's logically impossible for there to be infinitely many things, well, then God can't create infinitely many things, but that's not really a problem, because it's a logical impossibility for him to have done. So any world he created would have to be, in some sense, finitely bounded. Right? Yeah.
I find it interesting that we even use the word logic when we're talking about God.
Right. Right, yeah, right. So this is something, of course, philosophers are accused of rationalizing maybe a little bit too much. That's definitely true. But I do think it's important, and actually it's one of the three things. So as we start the next two arguments, I was trying to think about what terms or like what kind of technical terminology we're not going to be able to avoid. Because most of what I did last time, I tried to, and I'm still consciously trying to, avoid any technical terminology that it's if it's overly technical and I don't think it's going to do any good, I try to avoid it. Even though I have a knee-jerk habit because it's sort of the air that I breathe, I try to avoid it where it's not necessary. But we're going to have to do at least three technical terms tonight, without which we're not going to be able to unpack the following two arguments. And one of those will be logically possible wrongs. And so we're going to have to talk about what it means to have a logically possible world, and then what role that plays in unpacking arguments for God's existence, or even just unpacking things in general philosophically. I'm going to suggest that the notion of logically possible worlds is a very philosophically technical concept, let's say, but it's extremely useful for all kinds of argument, not just arguments for God's existence, but arguments across the board. It's actually a really useful way to think about possibility, necessity, and impossibility. And it helps us get clearer on what we mean by those things. And the other advantage, and this is another advantage I should have noted in arguments for God's existence, is, and this is a huge advantage, in arguing for God's existence, you actually inevitably have to form a clearer concept of God. And that's actually an advantage because it helps us understand what it even means when we're saying that God exists. So it's not just a vague, you know, there is a creator and he has a purpose for my life. That's perfectly well, good and true, but if you want to put philosophical meat on those bones, you're going to have to say more about the nature of God and think through carefully what those implications are. That's a little bit what the arguments we're going to look at are going to force us into doing tonight. So I think.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say, continuing what you said about how considering these questions not only does the learning part of it, but also lets us know God a little bit better and
right.
understand Him a little bit better, is also and helps answer questions such as when I've heard, like, what did God spend His time doing before the creation?
Right, exactly.
Like, yes. At first blush, you said an interesting question, but you know, now we're talking about the concept of time and infinity and how God exists of time.
Right. And so the typical answer would just come from Augustine. I think it's exactly the right answer, which is just there is no time before time begins. Right? It's not as though God is twiddling his thumb for however many trillions or infinitely many years, and then decides one day, I'm going to create a universe. So what was he doing for all of the time before the universe began? No. The concept of a universe involves a limit or a beginning to time itself. So it doesn't make good sense to ask what God was doing temporally prior to creation. It can still make good sense to ask about the kind of causally prior to creation. Mm-hmm. Right? And so philosophers will talk about causal sequences as being different from temporal sequences. We usually think about those as running alongside each other. Like in you know your typical world, a cause and an effect are going to go along with time in step. But you can think of examples. So one example that some people have used from Kant, maybe this is a misuse of Kant, but in any case, people use it from Kant and they say something like, well, I can imagine a cause and effect that are simultaneous, where one did not precede the other, right? They've just always been the same. So they've always existed, but one really is the effect of the other. So imagine a universe that's infinitely old, bracket all the concerns we just raised about infinitely old universes, and then say, put a bowling ball on a pillow. The pillow has an indent on it, right? The shape of a bowling ball. Well, what is the cause of the pillow's having an indent? Well, it's the bowling ball. Okay, there is a cause-effect relation, but if the bowling ball has always been on the pillow, there's never been a time in the entire history of this imagined universe where the bowling ball wasn't on the pillow, then you have an effect and a cause that are forever simultaneous. It's not the case that one is temporally prior to the other. At any point in time, they are both simultaneous. And so one just is the cause of the other in a way that's, you know, it doesn't have to follow a temporal sequence. You can imagine something even wilder. Like, let's imagine in this room right now, out of nowhere, a goat showed up with a little sign around its neck saying, you know, we invent the time machine in 2240 or something like that. Well, okay, well then we would all probably infer that it didn't just come out of nowhere with a sign that happens to say that. Probably in the future, somebody invented a time machine, decided to test it, put a goat in, and send it back to, for whatever reason, to the church basement here, and it's on the table. Okay, well, that would be a cause and effect relation that runs backwards in time. Now, there's a question about whether those are physically possible. We can argue that maybe those are not physically possible. But conceptually, it's clearly possible. There's no conceptual incoherence about imagining somebody using a time machine that way. So that just goes to show that causal sequences and temporal sequences are not the same thing. Right? They usually run in parallel, that's how we usually think of them, but they don't need to run in parallel. It's not logically necessary that they run in parallel. So if you can distinguish them conceptually that way, then it's probably meaningful to talk about one without the other. And that's the kind of talk you would have to use to talk about God creating the universe, in a sense that there's a causal sequence, right, prior to the universe existing, logically prior to the universe existing, and then logically posterior to the universe existing. But that's not a temporal sequence. It's not as though any time has passed for God or anything like that. So.
What about dimensions, different dimensions?
Right. Well, okay, so this is something I have to admit. Whenever people talk about multiple dimensions, I wonder what it is they mean when they say it. Because there are different ways of thinking about dimensions. Like if you were to, if you're thinking about space, right, as a three-dimensional thing, and then you add time to it, and you say, well, this is a four-dimensional thing now. You can do that, and you can keep adding dimensions. But it doesn't necessarily follow that there is such a thing as, say, space-time, right? So some physicists, I think, will talk like that. They'll say, there really is space-time, because look, I can geometrize it in this way, and it just makes perfect sense, and the math works out, and that's a little bit, I like what one philosopher says, where he says, look, if I have a graph, and I just put temperature on one side and pressure on the other, and it always works, and it helps me make all these calculations, it doesn't follow from that there's such a thing as temperature pressure, right? You could just have, there is temperature and there is pressure, and we're just putting this on a graph for certain purposes, and it's very useful to talk. Maybe it's even useful to talk about temperature pressure in some context. But it doesn't follow that there really is such a thing. Similarly, it doesn't follow that there's such a thing as space-time. Maybe there is, but it doesn't follow just from mathematical modeling that it would really exist. And so the same thing is true for if you add a ton of dimensions. There are 11 dimensions we're going to set, and we're going to put them all into this nice equation. Well, that might be extremely useful, right, for doing high-level physics, but it's not clear that that's as useful for doing what's called metaphysics, which is a very misunderstood term, but essentially what metaphysics means is the study of reality, or the study of the furniture of the real world. So some people think metaphysics, that this is actually a little bit of a joke. It's not a joke anymore because people don't remember, don't know this anymore, but they think of metaphysics as being that which is after physics, right? So physics describes reality up to a point, and then you have everything after that, and that's going to be metaphysics. That's actually not the way the term is used. Philosophers are just really, really bad at naming things. The reason we call it the metaphysics is that in Aristotle's corpus, he has something called the physics, and then he goes on to do something else. And philosophers said, well, what do we call that? Well, let's call it the metaphysics, because it comes after the physics. That's what metaphysics actually means. But they mean it's what Aristotle did after he was done doing physics. Okay, so what did Aristotle do after he was done doing physics? He's basically trying to give you a picture of reality at the most fundamental level. So what really exists in the world. Now, the way that used to be thought of, especially by like ancient Greek philosophers, was what principles are eternal and just have always been around and they're fundamental. But how that came to be thought of later in philosophy was what is part of reality? What's part of the real world? If something is part of the real world on your view of the world, then that's your metaphysics. So suppose you're a physicalist, right? You think the only things that exist are the objects or entities described by our best science. Well, then your metaphysics is materialism. Materialism is a metaphysic, right? And if you have a richer metaphysics than that, well, then you're going to have a different kind of metaphysical framework. Maybe angels exist, maybe souls exist, maybe numbers exist, maybe propositions exist, maybe logically possible worlds exist. There are tons of things that philosophers can imagine existing. And then, depending on what you think actually exists, you're going to end up in one camp on metaphysics or another, right? And there are metaphysics that are even smaller than materialism, right? Like a solipsist thinks, I'm the only thing that exists, everything else is a dream. Okay, well, that gives you a very, very simple view of the world. It's not very convincing, most people aren't solipsists. But that would be your metaphysic. It's just, I exist, everything else is an illusion, right? And that's a much smaller metaphysic than materialism. And then there are bigger metaphysics than materialism that allow more things in. Many mathematicians think that you have to, for various reasons, allow for the real existence of numbers, like the number two, right? And part of that is because, so suppose you ask, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. What makes that statement true? Now, if your answer to that is going to be in terms of physics, then you're actually going to have a really hard time, not only because physics is complicated, especially at the quantum level, and it's not clear how you're going to derive that from physics, but also because in a world where there were no physical objects, a logically possible world, 2 + 2 = 4 should still be true. So its truth can't be derived or grounded just in physical relations. And some mathematicians think about that and go, oh yeah, mathematical statements are true. They're true no matter what turns out to be the case in physics, so we're not going to ground the truth of it in physics. We've got to ground it in something. Well, what do we ground it in? Ah, numbers. Numbers exist. The numbers have to exist. So they have this huge ontology with all these numbers existing. If you're convinced of that, then you're going to have a metaphysic that allows for numbers. Right? Yeah.
But is saying 2 + 2 = 4 really all that different and universal than saying Baker beats Rock?
Right. Good question. So there are views in the philosophy of math where some people say there's a kind of conventionalism about our mathematical language, and so all of these mathematical statements are true only relative to a specific language or a language game or something like that. If you adopt that view, then sure, you're not going to have to admit numbers. In fact, most philosophers of math do not think that numbers really exist. Most mathematicians do seem to think that numbers really exist, right? Mathematicians tend to be knee-jerk Platonists because they think about numbers all day, so it just seems normal. Of course they exist, they have to exist. But most philosophers adopt one of like many, many different views that will try to explain how you could get mathematical statements as being really true, or maybe as being useful fictions, or maybe as being like there are these different philosophical views of these statements. But I think the common person, like just grab somebody off the street and ask them, 2 + 2 = 4, right? Yes, okay, so how? Right? What makes that true? If I say snow is white, I can go out into the world and point at snow and say, look, that's white, that's your truth maker, right? It makes the statement true. Okay, what are you going to point at to say 2 + 2 = 4? And most people kind of intuitively know, or they think, yeah, the statement really has to be true. But it's true in a way that I can't just point at something that might not have been there and say, that's what makes it true. No, that might not have been there, right? So it's got to be true in some deeper sense, right? And of course, I mean, philosophical intuitions are varied here, but I think most people kind of feel that pull, which is why most people tend to have a metaphysical system that's a little bit richer than materialism. You kind of have to be argued into materialism. And for most people, I think that to get to materialism, you have to cut a bunch of stuff out that seems intuitively plausible. There aren't very many people who start intuitively thinking materialism is right because they never thought that there were numbers, or they never thought there were moral truths, or that there were, you know, logical truths, or any of these other things. So, okay, I'm gonna have to rush a little bit now. So I said that there were three terms that we had to define for tonight. One of them is metaphysics, so I've already got that one down. That's fine. The second one is, I've already used it a little bit, logically possible worlds. So what a philosopher means by talking about a logically possible world is really just a picture of some way that reality could be. So a logically possible world is anything that is not logically contradictory, like a square circle is logically contradictory, and it describes some way the world could actually be. If I say there's a logically possible world where there are purple elephants, well, what I'm saying is, in some logically possible way reality could have been, there are purple elephants. It's logically possible for a mouse to give birth to an owl. Okay, that's logically possible. Philosophers don't care if it's physically possible or if it's absurd. It's not logically contradictory. It's a way the world might be. And it's a useful tool for thinking about the limits of possibility, not just in terms of physics, because physics might be, you know, relatively constrained, but you can even imagine, once you learn the physical laws that govern our world, you might easily imagine what would our universe have looked like if those laws had been a little bit different, right? E equals mc squared. Okay, sure, but what if E equals mc cubed? Couldn't it have been that way? Well, conceptually it could have been, right? Or at least arguably conceptually it could have been. So how do you talk meaningfully about that and then differentiate it from a world where there are square triangles or something like that? Well, the way that you do that is by getting clear on making a distinction between the logically impossible and the logically possible. So you would normally think of physical possibility as falling all inside the circle of logical possibility. Logical possibility is just the widest circle that you can make good sense of. And logically possible worlds then are everything within that big circle. Every way the world could possibly have been without contradiction. And then you can think about, well, so what does that look like? What does that leave you with? So whenever philosophers talk about a logically possible world, what they're doing is they're trying to give you a picture of the way the world could be and saying, doesn't that seem like it could have been the case? Yes, okay, so there's at least one possible world where that is the case. So long as it's conceptually coherent, there really is a world at which or in which that's true. Okay, does everybody kind of follow that or have any questions about that? Because that is going to be really important for both of the arguments that we're going to look at in just a little bit.
See, for me, that would mean another dimension.
Okay, right. Well, you could think about it that way. You could think about it as a logical dimension of reality as opposed to whatever physical dimensions you have. So you can embed all your physical dimensions of reality into this larger dimension of logical space, right? And some philosophers talk that way. They talk about logical space, and we occupy some of the logical space, logically possible world. So our world is actual. It follows from its being actual that it's got to be logically possible. There's no question about whether our world is possible. It's clearly possible, but the scope of possibility is presumably a lot wider than not only the factual, but even what would be physically possible given our physics and laws and so on. So yeah, you can talk about, you can think about logic as a dimension, right? And it's perfectly, in fact, in some sense, that is what philosophers are doing when they talk about logically possible spaces or logically possible worlds. And again, this is a kind of heuristic. So let me give a quick example of because this will be important, of distinguishing between what a philosopher means by a world and maybe even what like a physicist means by a world. So a physicist might refer to our universe and say, well, this is the world, right? But some physicists think, well, there are multiverse hypotheses. Maybe there are, you know, infinitely many universes in a kind of multiverse ensemble. Well, there are some reasons for thinking that that could make sense, that you could talk meaningfully about that in the language of physics. But the philosopher is going to look at that and say, All you're saying is it's logically possible that there be a multiverse. So there is a logically possible world in which there is a multiverse. So the notion of world here is wider than universe. It's not the same as universe. It could encompass everything, including if there's a multiverse. And so philosophers will say it's logically possible that there not be a multiverse, and it's logically possible that there be a multiverse. So these are two real possibilities, and they fit within the space of the possible, right? Okay, I hope I've made that clear enough. That's gonna become important, like I said, for these arguments. The third concept that we're gonna need, though, is the concept of contingency. So this is a little bit more technical, but the basic idea of a contingent thing, or the property of being contingent, is being non-necessary, or existing such that it exists in some possible worlds, or at least one possible world, but it doesn't exist in all possible worlds. So if something exists in all possible worlds, if something exists in all possible worlds, then it would be a necessary thing. If something exists in some possible worlds but not others, we talk about it being contingent. And typically, more colloquially, you would think of a contingent thing as not explaining itself, right? So this table exists, it's part of the real world. But we might reasonably ask about the table, well, where did it come from? Who made it? How did it get here? What's the story about its coming into existence? Because presumably it didn't just pop into existence uncaused out of absolutely nothing with no cause or explanation whatsoever. If you think that's plausible, then you're going to share an intuition with philosophers, which is, the technical term for it is called the principle of sufficient reason. So if you think for anything that is contingent, like this table, or yourself, or even the world, the universe as it happens to be, maybe the laws of physics as they happen to be, whatever it is that could have been different, but is that way, so it's contingent, in some sense you're going to want to say it kind of calls out for an explanation. And that's what this second kind of cosmological argument tries to do. So the first kind of cosmological argument says the universe needed a beginning. If the universe needed a beginning, you can get right to a cause. The second kind will say, forget the beginning. Just throw the idea that the universe had a beginning out. It doesn't matter. Even if the universe is infinitely old, the key point is that the universe is contingent. It could have been otherwise, and for anything that could have been otherwise, there should be some rational explanation of why it is the way that it is. Okay, what would that explanation have to look like? This argument is going to suggest, well, if you take the set of all contingent things, just put everything together into a set, the table, you, everything else in the universe, everything else that exists, such that it needn't have existed. Right, there's at least one logically possible world where it didn't exist. Well, then you're going to want to ask, what explains that whole set? Because if you put contingent things together, you can explain those individual members of a set. Right? So explain all the children on Earth today. Well, you can explain it in terms of the set of all their parents today, or something like that. Or at least partially explain why all the children exist with reference to all of their parents. But if you just have a set of everything that does not contain in itself the reason of its own existence, it doesn't just explain itself, it exists such that it cries out for an explanation, well then, what would that explanation look like? And philosophers have argued that the only kind of explanation that is even possible, that's even on the table as an explanation, is in terms of a necessary being, or a necessary explanation. You have to be able to account for the set of all contingent things. You can't just refer back infinitely to an infinitely long contingent chain. because even if you say, well, for this part of the universe, right, or the universe as it's existed up until this point, there's a prior contingent set of things that would explain the rest, right? Okay, but we're asking about the set of everything. Put all contingent things into one set. The set is contingent. Everything in the set is contingent, so the set is definitely contingent. It didn't need to exist, right? Even if you think the universe is infinitely old, you should admit that it's logically possible that the universe had a beginning, right? So what explains the set of all contingent things? Plausibly, at least, what explains it, if anything, is an incontingent being. And so in this way, you can construct a cosmological argument for God's existence that is, I think, actually stronger than the Kalam. It's a little less intuitive, which is why I started with the Kalam, because the Kalam is a little bit easier to digest. But this argument is stronger in the sense that even if somebody wants to quibble over whether the universe had a beginning, you can still say, okay, put that aside. There has to be a rational explanation for the set of all contingent things. They don't explain themselves, right? And it's kind of hopeless to look at contingent things and think, some philosophers have tried to do this. They said, give me this chain of all contingent things and just number them, right? Like E1, E2, E3, and so on. Well, for any one of them, E2, I can show you that it's explained by E1, and E3 is explained by E2, and so on. So every member of the set is explained. Well, job done. Shouldn't that be enough? Every member of the set is explained, so shouldn't that be enough? It doesn't call out for any deeper explanation. But there are serious problems with that suggestion. So one way to see this is, suppose you say, I'm gonna steal this example from Pris. So suppose you say, Tom is going to a party, right? And Lisa is going to a party. They're going to the same party. Why is Tom going to the party? Well, because Lisa's going to the party. Why is Lisa going to the party? Well, because Tom's going to be there. Tom's going to the party. Okay, well, now you've explained why Tom is going to the party, and you've explained why Lisa is going to the party. You haven't really explained why both Tom and Lisa are going to the party. You've left out a deeper explanation for the whole thing. When you put those explanations that you had together, it still isn't enough to explain the set of things, right? And this is true with respect to the set of all contingent things. Even if it were the case that each individual member of that set had an explanation, still the set itself cries out for a deeper explanation. Why this set instead of a completely different set? There should be an explanation for that. But if there is an explanation for it, it has to be in terms of an incontingent being or a necessary being. So a metaphysically necessary being is a being that populates all logically possible worlds. It's necessary, and therefore it can serve as the explanation, or at least with a little bit more work, but it can serve as the explanation for the set of all contingent things. And remember when we talked about the nature of God before, one of the features that we talked about was his necessary existence, that God has to exist in such a way that he isn't dependent, for example, on a set of properties. It's not like there's a metaphysical ingredient list for God. God is just the most basic thing in all of existence, and God explains everything else that exists. At least that's what theism suggests. And so here you get a pretty good idea of the usefulness of God as an explanation, looking out at the world and saying the world is contingent, the set of all things in the world is contingent, and it cries out for an explanation. There should be some explanation for it. But if there is, it can't be in terms of a contingent thing, because then you would just have a circular, it'd be exactly the same as saying what we said before about, you know, a timeless, spaceless, immaterial God. If you didn't have that, you'd be arguing a circle about what caused the universe to exist. So here, you have to say, it can't be a contingent thing that explains the set of all contingent things. from which it follows that it's an incontingent thing, which means that it's metaphysically necessary, it occupies all possible worlds, and that is a pretty conventional, it's not undisputed, but it's a pretty conventional way of thinking about God's existence, or the hypothesis of theism, from a philosophical vantage point. Philosophers would typically talk about God being a maximally great being, and part of what that means is he's necessary, he's incontingent, his nature involves an explanation of itself, right? Or to put this in medieval terms, his essence involves his existence. And that makes God uniquely capable of serving as a rational explanation of why anything at all exists, and why, in particular, this world, this actual world, that's a logically possible world, why does it exist with all of its contingent beings and objects? Well, God explains that, and in the absence of appealing to an incontingent being, you actually don't have any explanation at all, and you even in principle can't, because the distinction between contingent and incontingent is exhaustive, right? Once you've piled up all of the contingent things, and then you pile up all of the incontingent things, what you have left over is no things. There are no other things. Everything is either contingent, such that it didn't need to be, or incontingent, such that it is necessary across all possible worlds, right? All possible space. And so this way of thinking about the structure of reality places God on the ground floor and says he's incontingent, and he serves as a rational explanation for why anything at all happens to exist. So, okay. I tried to do that with as little technicality as I could. I'm not perfect at that, but with as little technicality as I could. Does anyone have any questions about that, or want to go over some of it, or ask any, have any critical? Yeah.
So there might hypothetically be other things other than God that are not contingent.
Right, that are incontingent. That's right, yeah. So this is actually something that philosophers, so there's an atheist philosopher named Graham Oppie. I think he's probably the world's smartest atheist by far.
Yeah.
Really, really smart guy. Like, he's described as scary smart. And he's very charitable to theists. But he actually opts for an answer exactly like that. He says, okay, I am going to posit an incontingent being, and you might even be able to derive other properties of it, like it has to be immensely powerful. In fact, it has to be powerful at least in the sense that it not only explains all of reality as it is, but across the space of possible worlds, it could explain any reality within that space, right? And so you keep adding properties to it, but he's going to say, but this doesn't get you all the way to something like a personal creator. And this brings us back again to the concept of these arguments having certain boundaries or limits. You may not be able to get all the way to the full, rich, theistic picture of God that we have with any one of these arguments. But again, if you think of these arguments cumulatively, you can think, well, okay, at very least, I've shown you that there is some incredibly powerful, necessarily existent thing that sufficiently explains the existence of reality as it is, and that would explain the existence of reality however it turned out to be. That gets us pretty close. Maybe it doesn't do all the work, but it gets us pretty close to God's existence. And if somebody wants to say, I agree with that, but I don't think that this being is moral, or I don't think that this being has the properties of a person or something like that, okay, fine. Well and good. Maybe there are ways to derive that from this argument. Some philosophers do try to do that, but we don't even have to go that far yet. We can just say, fine, that's enough. I have gotten you far enough with this argument that I'm happy for the work that this one argument did. This is enough. And although, as I just said, there are serious philosophers who are atheists or agnostics who opt for a solution like that, it's actually extremely rare. And part of the reason for its rarity is that abductively, or just inferring to the best explanation, which is what most people typically do, abductively, once you get this close to God, it just starts to look more and more plausible that you should just say God is the best explanation. Because it will turn out that God is an incredibly simple explanation, that it's a powerful explanation, right? So it has a lot of explanatory power and scope. If you can work out with other arguments that we're going to look at that God is the best explanation for, let's say, moral properties in the world. Well, okay. What somebody else would have to do is come up with a new explanation for that feature of the world, whereas the theist can say, I'm using the same explanation again. Right? I don't need to complicate the picture. God still serves as a perfectly good explanation of that. Or why does the world appear to be designed in certain ways? So we'll look at design arguments later. Well, again, on the theistic view, I have a simple explanation for that. It comes back to the same hypothesis I had before. God is the one at the ground level of reality who designed it, who has more properties, and so on. So instead of multiplying explanations that are completely different and that at some point start to look ad hoc, you just bring everything together into one parsimonious explanation. So again, you can't do that with any one of these arguments, but each of these arguments is a kind of step in that direction. And most atheistic responses to this argument actually go after and challenge the very principle of the argument, what's called the principle of sufficient reason. So they suggest that, yes, things are contingent. And maybe in some sense, we wish there were an explanation for them, right? And maybe in most cases, contingent things have explanations for them. But it doesn't mean that there will always be an explanation there, right? The world doesn't guarantee that we're going to have an explanation for everything. So maybe there are what are called brute facts. And maybe reality is one such fact. So a brute fact is just, it happens to be true. It didn't have to be true. It's not necessary. Nothing further can be said. There's no deeper explanation of why it's true. It's just a gift. It's just a just-so story, and that's the end of it. Right? That's what's called a brute fact. Most atheists will say that's the case with respect to the world. It's there, and that's the end of the story. Maybe you want there to be a deeper explanation. Maybe there's a sense in which it would satisfy you intellectually that there be a deeper explanation, but the world doesn't owe you an explanation. Maybe the explanation stopped there, and that's it, right? So those are two ways, at least, that atheists can deal with the argument. One of them is attacking the principle. The other is doing what you suggested, which is, okay, yeah, I'll grant that there's an incontingent being that explains reality as it is. I just don't go so far as to call that God. Right? I'm going to call that something else. So, yeah.
But I feel like that one at least is getting at something, because the first one is just basically saying, just because I said so, and I'm not going to take any further questions.
Right.
Like it's not an answer.
Right. Right. Well, so I have a very, very strong intuition. I have friends who are philosophers who make fun of me for this intuition because it's so strong in me. I think that the principle of sufficient reason is true. Right? Now, there are different ways to articulate this principle. Some of them are stronger than others. I'm like near the point of saying even the strongest one is right. So the strongest version of this principle would say, for anything that's true, there is a rational explanation of why it is true. Period. Done. Right? Even 2 + 2 = 4, you should be able to give some rational explanation of why it's true. A slightly weaker version of the principle, which will work for this argument, is for any contingent fact, for anything that's true that didn't have to be true, there has to be some sufficient reason of its being true. And that will do all the work you need for this kind of argument, because it picks out contingent things and it says the set of all contingent things cries out for an explanation the same way that any individual contingent thing cries out for an explanation. So there really should be one. But there are weaker versions of this principle, right? So this philosopher Timothy O'Connor who says, okay, fine, let's imagine that the principle of sufficient reason is not always true. But let's, because maybe there are some clever, you know, philosophical counterexamples. Fine, but for anything that is contingently true and which possibly has an explanation, it does have an explanation. So he's slightly weakened the principle, or at least some people say that. Some people actually think you can derive the stronger one from this weaker one logically, but put that aside. So this is, on its face, it's a slightly weaker claim, right? So it says maybe there are some contingent things that couldn't logically possibly have an explanation. Even if I spot you that, So long as it's logically possible that there be an explanation, there is an explanation. And then the question comes with respect to the set of all contingent things, is it logically possible for there to be an explanation? Yes, then there just is. There must be an explanation. And there are increasingly weaker and weaker versions of this principle. There's actually at least one way to run this argument without using the principle at all, which is very impressive. And it just says something like, you know, there must be an explanation for the first appearance of the property of contingency, right? So if contingency is a property that is instantiated in some possible world, then the very first instantiation of that property should have an explanation, at least possibly has an explanation. That will also get you to there must be an incontingent thing, because you can't appeal to a contingent thing causing the first instance of the property of contingency. So it gets you to incontingency, and you get the rest of the argument. The rest of the argument can be adjusted accordingly, right? So I'm happy to use those weaker and weaker versions, even though I'm up here and I think like this is right. I think the stronger version of this is just right. But you could use any of these if somebody were nitpicking and saying, well, maybe the principle isn't right. Okay, fine. Use weaker and weaker and weaker principles to get exactly the same conclusion. And in some sense, that actually makes your argument stronger and stronger, because it's harder and harder to come up with excuses for escaping it, which is, again, why some atheistic philosophers just concede the point, yeah, there's an incontingent thing, but you didn't get all the way to God. It's not God, right? And so, again, that's fine. We can take piecemeal steps towards the conclusion that God exists. This gets us a fair distance. That's all we really need out of any one argument, I think. So, yeah?
Of transigence, of what you're describing?
Yes, so actually, the philosopher who's most known for this is probably Leibniz. Leibniz was an early modern philosopher, and so some people refer to this kind of cosmological argument as a Leibnizian cosmological argument. So in philosophy textbooks and so on, that's how they refer to it. It's not how everyone refers to it anymore, because it's been a very long time since Leibniz was around, but he's generally credited with having come up for the first time with a version of a cosmological argument that is in some sense strictly logical. It doesn't depend on the universe having a beginning, and it doesn't even depend on, so Aquinas in the Middle Ages comes up with a version of the cosmological argument for a kind of first mover in an Aristotelian sense, and even his argument will say you don't need a beginning of the universe. Even if it goes on infinitely, I'll show you that you need a first mover. But people kind of accused Aquinas later on, retrospectively, they accused Aquinas of relying too heavily on Aristotle. So his arguments don't require a lot, but they require an Aristotelian framework, or some people even think it requires an Aristotelian physics. So what Leibniz did is he said, okay, I'm going to get rid of the beginning of the universe, I'm going to get rid of Aristotle's physics, I'm going to get rid of any physics, I'm just going to put this in a strictly logical argument. How does the argument go? You need an explanation for something that does not explain itself, whether that be motion or whatever else. Let's just bring it back to that principle. So for contingent things, there should be an explanation. He's the first one to really articulate it in that way. And so he's the one who's credited with being the father of these kinds of arguments. He's also, I believe, the first philosopher to really use the language of logically possible worlds. And ever since him, that's just been a staple in philosophy. Everybody in philosophy talks about logically possible worlds, but that really comes, it's really a contribution from Leibniz. Okay, we've already done a lot. I think we will now actually take a break if we don't have any more questions about this argument. And when we come back, we'll take like a 10-minute break, I think. When we come back, I want to try to quickly run through the argument that I know you really hate, the ontological argument for God's existence, which is going to be completely different from these cosmological arguments. let's take a quick break, have some coffee, everything else, and then we'll come back.